Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Here with me today is inevitably not professional holiday taker and dog lover Thea Leonarduzzi, but professional indie pop star and non-reader of the TLS, Lucy Dallas. Lucy, hello.
Hello.
You're not strictly a professional indie pop star anymore.
I'm not a pop star and I am a reader. Hey. How about that? How about an absolute negative of what you just said?
Were you ever classed as a professional pop star?
Well, if you mean, do you ever make any money out of it? Yes.
Did you?
Yeah.
Good money.
Would you like to know exactly
how
much?
No, I think that would be vulgar.
I wasn't going to tell you. No.
But a living?
Define living.
Yeah, not a proper living.
Well, I was at university, so.
Yeah, all right. Here's the bit where I stop bothering Lucy and plug subscription of the TLS to give you a special offer available only to our podcast listeners. If you live in the US or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. You'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. Coming up on this week's show, our theme in the paper is the avant-garde, that terrifying urge to be original at all costs. We have lots of pieces on the subject, including by experimental editor Michael the Dr. Keynes, on the subject of unusual literary criticism. He'll be in the studio. We live in a world of conspiracy theories. I once did a phone-in on the subject, and boy, do some people believe some strange things. Of course, I would say that being a member of the MSM controlled by a shadowy, all-powerful cabal. Thankfully, historian Jill Lepore will join us to explain where this all began. And philosophy editor Tim Crane talks us through the problem of free will. Well, he had no choice when you think about it. The great lesson of life, it seems to me, is that almost everything happens by chance or accident, a concatenation of blunders and choices that only seem inevitable in retrospect. Where there is a reason, it's almost always cock-up, not conspiracy. And yet, as Jill Lepore points out this week, having reviewed a whole bunch of books on the subject, conspiracy theory has a very long history. People have been always striving for explanations, especially when accident is either not convincing or not comforting. But conspiracy mongering does seem to be a peculiar symptom of modernity, to scapegoat, to congregate online and swap evidence and so on. What does the history tell us about where we are now? Jill joins Lucy and me on the line now. Jill, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Very good. Now, is it too simplistic to say that as humans have recognised their own individual agency more, they've speculated about conspiracy more too? Is there's been a sort of, as we've developed as humans, we've kind of developed conspiratorial theories at the same time?
Well, yeah, I love your intro, how really it comes down to cock-up, because that is really what most of human happenstance is. But I think it's not so much our turn to being individuals, but really we could think about it as secularization. The great comfort of thinking that everything that happens is part of a greater design by God is a great vaccination against conspiratorial thinking, right? Like that, it in a sense, that's a conspiracy, but it's a conspiracy of, you know, the gods or God and Satan or the angels or Satan himself. Or, I mean, there's a lot in our world that causes us pain and that is mysterious to us. And sweeping explanations of supernatural forces for most of human history have done the work of answering our questions and quieting our fears.
And presumably, I mean, 1,000 years ago, people's lives were genuinely ruled by a shadowy cabal of a few people. I mean, that wasn't a conspiracy theory. There were all powerful people constructing the world around them. As people have got more individual, as the world has got more complex, then there's room for false conspiracy theories, maybe.
Yeah, because there's also the democratization of knowledge. And so the more, and the systemization of knowledge, so the more schemes of knowledge offer us the ability to see things that were previously invisible. I mean, think about x-rays or germs or DNA, the agents that cause cancer, the secrets inside of a woman's body that allow us to see how conception happens, things that in earlier eras are mysterious, unknowable, invisible, become visible. We gain a lot of, and then that knowledge becomes not only visible, but available to everyone. We gain this sort of massive really soaring, limitless confidence that everything can be known and that everyone can know it. And so we go from this world where pretty much everything is a mystery. And as you say, it's not bad logic to imagine that people in power are conspiring against you, to a world in which very little is left mysterious. And then that just opens up this space for, well, there must be an explanation. And I myself can come up with the explanation if I just bring all the evidence together.
It's striking me when you talk about being able to see germs and, you know, and you said earlier it's a vaccination against conspiracy theories, that actually vaccination itself is now the site of a new one. And I was thinking about that one, because that one, it's difficult to see the benefit, because that the vaccination sort of idea, even though that comes from, there is provable science, as you say, that we can see, that has been verified, there is still this idea that that's a conspiracy theory, which I never quite understood, because I don't understand whose benefit it would be. Do you see what I mean? To spread the disease.
I think it's a deep, dark hole to try to understand the logic behind the anti-vaccination argument, right? Who is scheming to destroy the health of our children?
Yeah.
But if you think about, you know, 70 years ago in the 1950s, when Jonas Salk, you know, discovers and perfects the polio vaccine, that's a moment of the heyday of expert authority in the West, right? There's been this revolution in the biomedical sciences. There's this incredible enthusiasm for all kinds of new knowledge. I mean, that's the same decade that sees Watson and Crick, you know, kind of crack the code, the DNA code, that there's this explosion of enthusiasm and excitement about what can be known and who we will all live better lives for the work that these experts are doing. But the 1950s is also the heyday of conspiracy theory in the form of McCarthyism. Mm. There's something kind of, I think, tied together there with these kind of great scientific leaps that, oh, well, there's this other invisible thing, right? And it's all these communists are working for the federal government, or you know, there is this menace of homosexuals around the world, or there's a kind of renewed anti-Semitic conspiracy theory in the 1950s as well, that there's always going to be this kind of reaction against new forms of knowledge.
Back further. Your essay starts a little before that. You talk about President Garfield's assassination in 1881. And so this world that you're describing in the 50s may have its origins in the sort of 1880s, the late Victorian period, where a lot of scientific advances are happening. Individualism is on the rise. And maybe what you're saying is that's the petri dish for the beginnings of conspiracies.
Yeah, I really think the 1880s are where a lot happens and turns. So in 1881, the American president, James Garfield, is shot. And it takes him a while to die. And the motivation of the guy who shot him is somewhat mysterious. But it's at a really crucial turning point, kind of epistemologically, because daily newspapers have a new presence in the reading lives of ordinary people. And there's this whole new kind of pulp world of investigation, the birth of the detective. Like, that's the decade that sees the beginnings of Sherlock Holmes, right? So, and journalism as a field is really considers itself founded in that era in the 1880s. So we have all these journalists who consider themselves to be sleuths. It's the first private eye, where I live in New England, first private eye opens his doors in 1879. People are kind of obsessed with the work of detection and kind of prying into other people's lives and then publishing. It's also the age, you know, the big real kind of popularization of photography. So you can kind of spy on one another. And so when Garfield is shot, all the newspapers in the country essentially lead a kind of crowdsourced investigation into what possibly could have been the motive of the guy who shot him. And there are these various different theories about, well, you know, he was in love with the president. Oh, he was actually himself a foreign spy, or he was a spurned office seeker. And then there's a theory that he was just the dupe. He was hired by a you know, a cabal of secret anti-Garfield politicians as part of what came to be called the conspiracy theory. So there's the, you know, there's a kind of madman theory, there's a homosexual spurned lover theory, there's a spurned office secret theory, and then there's the conspiracy theory. And that's where that the term that we, you know, now use all the time, because we see this everywhere, comes into common use. But it's very much a part of the thrill of the spectacle of a tragedy and a large number of people involved in trying to make sense of it.
And actually, when you talk about the 1880s of this rise in technology, you could easily be talking in the same way about the 21st century, you know, a new technology which brings people together, which makes the world smaller, which makes people able to pry into the lives of their colleagues and people they don't even know more easily. The sort of revolution you're talking about in 1880 could be the Silicon Valley revolution of the beginning of the 21st century.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's all those same features. Also, it also accelerates the transmission of information, because the dailiness of the papers, or there'll be like three papers a day, like a city will have three different editions. There's a great speeding up of how information is circulating, which of course is also true in our own day. And, you know, the way I always think of it is that when the technology of communication outpaces the speed of thought, things tend to go pretty badly. Yes. And people, you know, adjust a little bit and try to figure out ways to slow down, or maybe newspapers begin to think, well, maybe they're actually riling things up, and they begin to adopt new rules and become more cautious. And that's where, you know, you get by the 1890s, the great kind of cult of objectivity in the news. There's this new kind of commitment to, okay, we have to calm ourselves down, we have to look at the facts, we have to only report what we can verify. Because
how did that turn out in the end, Joe?
It's going well.
Yeah,
going well. Well, you know, that has its moment, that reaction to this, the kind of zaniness of the explosion of a new form of knowledge making and communications technology.
Can we say, though, here's a thing. I never believe conspiracy theories, Jill, ever, because they're always too complicated and most people are too incompetent to gather together to do anything secretly, because that's not how human nature works. But as you make clear in your piece, has reality ever actually buttressed the notion of conspiracy theories? Because we wouldn't want to believe that the CIA plotted to sort of use LSD to destabilize Cuba, or try to plot to bring down the Guatemalan government, or Watergate, or any of those other things. There is moments where, although we all scorn conspiracy theories and government up to no good, there's also evidence of it actually happening as well.
Yeah, and then the response is sort of wildly out of proportion to that. I mean, if you think about there's a tremendously vital way in which the revelations of the Pentagon Papers, which are published in 1971, demonstrate, you know, beyond a doubt that American presidents, you know, from Eisenhower forward, had been lying to the American people and lying to Congress about American engagement in Vietnam. That there was this conspiracy on the part of the people in the White House to misrepresent Americans' activities and also the various commitments in Vietnam. And shortly, you know, following immediately on the heels of that, in fact, as a result of a set of actions that kind of begin with the release of the Pentagon Papers, is the Watergate investigation, which reveals that Nixon, who was not part of the Pentagon Papers did not impugn Nixon, was engaged in this completely different cover-up and has been lying to the American people. And now this evidence, too, is unimpeachable because of the technology of audio recording. So Nixon had all these tapes. So you, on the one hand, you could sort of say rationally, holy crap, like the government's lying to me for my whole lifetime. And it's great that this has come out and now there are these investigations and we can kind of start afresh. Or you can say, now I don't believe anything. And a lot of people take that second course of action. I mean, it's really the first claims that the moon landing, the Apollo moon landing, we've just celebrated the 50th anniversary of this summer from 1969. The first claim that that was actually a hoax, that Stanley Kubrick of all people had made film of the moon landing, that this was a hoax committed on the American people. That follows just, you know, immediately on the heels of the Watergate scandal. And you kind of just see like a door opens and then suddenly the door is like pushed down by a mob and there's not even like a doorway left anymore. What, it's just this incredible spew of public doubt.
Is that not the consequence? I always think this is the consequence of postmodernism generally, which is that once you quite rightly start to show scepticism, you know, after centuries of having to just accept stuff that's told to you by authorities, it's very healthy and revolutionary to question workings and to look behind things. But the what seems to have been the corollary of that is once you stop believing in everything, you stop believing in anything. And we now live in a world where, not least because, you know, you've got a president who has no relationship to the truth whatsoever, but we don't believe anything. We believe what we want to believe collectively, and evidence no longer matters. So with the sort of the extension of this world, which starts in the 70s and is this postmodern effect, is that we're so sceptical, no authority exists which we can trust.
Yeah, and doesn't that make you think we're really ripe for some kind of giant religious revival? Like, I think this is just a very kind of fuzzy edge of a big religious revival, because this is kind of the people's desperate need to have something they can believe, I think, is a truly human characteristic. But I do think it's worth thinking about what happens in those middle decades of the 20th century, like the 50s, 60s, and 70s, because I think what happens is that the left and the right, who don't agree about anything, come to agree that nobody can know anything. So on the left, as you say, it's postmodernism, right? It's kind of from within the academy, there emerges this, you know, deeply theorized critical sensibility about the constructedness of all knowledge. All knowledge is situated. All knowledge is contingent. All knowledge tells you more about the speaker than about the spoken knowledge. So this incredibly elaborated criticism, especially criticism of scientific knowledge and of the supposed legitimacy of scientific knowledge, or in a hierarchy of knowledge, science is the one unassailable form of knowledge and everything else. So there's a whole assault on science that postmodern kind of historians of science in particular really engage in. But on the right, there's a completely different assault on truth, as it has often been called, because on the right, the conservatives, both in the UK and the US, kind of look around and they say, look, the problem with our attempt to seize power is that the press is dominated by liberals, and the courts are dominated by liberals, and the universities are dominated by liberals. Now, these are not like leftists. These are centrist liberals, you know, the kind of great kind of liberal consensus of the middle decades of the 20th century. But our institutions that arbitrate knowing anything, the courts, the universities, and the press, you know, are in the throes of liberalism. And so conservatives say to themselves quite explicitly, you know how we'll gain power is by attacking the legitimacy of these three institutions, of the university, of the press, and of the courts. And we will just say again and again and again, you can't believe anything that comes out of those institutions, because it's all politics. It's all politics disguised as knowledge. And so they begin their assault, which leads, you know, in the case of the press, the other strategy is to take over, to found an alternative press, you know, the sort of Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes variety, like we will slowly take, you know, create an alternative conservative media. And in the courts too, in the US, we'll take over the federal courts, taking over positions of appointing people to the courts, and that has worked as well. So by the time you get to the 1970s, decades of this kind of conservative assault on institutions of learning and of knowledge arbitration has really had an effect. And meanwhile, the within those institutions, they're themselves kicking themselves by, you know, you could argue that the press is kind of complicit and undermining itself in the 1970s. Yeah. Certainly the university with postmodernism is undermining the legitimacy of its own structures of knowledge. So kind of from the right and the left, they sort of meet in the middle, and the one thing they agree on is we can't know anything.
Jill, the great thing about your piece for us and this conversation is, and conspiracy theories generally, is that it opens up a prism through which you can pretty much look at any aspect of both historical and contemporary culture. What a great pleasure is speaking to you. Jill Lepore, thank you very much indeed.
Hey, thanks a lot.
It's a fascinating area, this. And once I read this piece, you kind of think that maybe we are in the era of the conspiracy
theory. Yes, and it's a really good point that it's partly because some of them, quite a lot of them, have turned out to be true, which you kind of don't want to say, because there's so many that are bonkers and so many that tend very quickly, as she says in her piece, towards the unpleasant and specifically towards the anti-Semitic.
Yeah, which we didn't even get a chance to. I mean, that's the other thing. We didn't even talk about racism and anti-Semitism, which is another area.
Huge strand.
But when I've
said
phones on it, there's the problem. You're exactly right. That there have been some examples of it, but nothing like the ones that are...
No.
that are considered.
And as you say, they're not usually as well structured and as secret.
But I remember I can't remember what it was. It was something that everyone in the media was not showing examples of terrorism committed.
Mm.
They existed, there was footage of them, but everyone in the media was gathering together. And I remember saying on this radio, tell me when this is happening. You know, when are people gathering together? How are they gathering together?
When do they get together and decide that it will all be a secret?
At what point? And you know, nothing, no one can organise anything in the world well. No one can organise. People can't cough in Downing Street without someone leaking it to the media. There's basically surveillance for everything. Everyone is talking all the time. To sustain a proper conspiracy, I actually think is beyond the competence.
Oh, yeah,
people.
I agree. And also the likelihood of The Guardian, The Times, The Telegraph, The Sun, The Mail, whoever,
everyone on
agree.
Everyone on Twitter, everyone on, everyone on Facebook.
Absolutely vanishingly unlikely.
It's a bit like the Shakespearean conspiracy theory that he didn't write it. Like,
oh, yes,
for that to work, they produced a folio in 1623 into a London where everyone who's known Shakespeare lives. And they go, oh, here, Shakespeare didn't write the play, so here he is, let's all pretend he did. And everyone goes, all right, then.
Okay, we'll pretend.
I have nothing to say.
Why would they?
It's just obviously, it's always cock-up. The great lesson in life.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Was it inevitable that I began this section by saying what I've just said? Was that question inevitable? Was that? And so on and on. Could I have started it differently if I'd wanted? Perhaps by singing a bit of Oasis or emitting a loud whistle? Are any of my decisions based on the power of free choice? Janine Ishmael has written an essay this week on the thorny old question of free will that talks about some of the philosophical questions raised by the subject. And regular listeners of the podcast will know that confronted by a philosophical problem, we have no choice but to turn to Tim Crane, our philosophy editor, and he has no choice but to come on the line and try to explain the answer to our tiny, confused brains. Tim, hello.
Hello, Stig.
Right, free will. How would you summarise the philosophical problem of free will?
Well, in many ways, it's a simple problem.
I'm glad to hear it.
It's best to think of it as a conflict between two things, things that seem to be obviously true. The first is that what we do seems to us to be up to us, under our control, and that, you know, when you decide to have pasta for dinner tonight, you can just decide that, or you can decide something else. It's just up to you. You can decide to eat whatever you have in your house, or not to eat at all, or to throw yourself out of the window. We have this choice, we have this element of control in our lives, which seems to be one of the most obvious things about our lives. But that's in conflict with another thing, which is perhaps less obvious, but it's very widely held by, I guess, scientists and thinkers since at least the 17th century, which is the idea that everything that happens is fixed by what happened before it. So even if you decided to have pasta tonight for dinner, because you'd been reading a book about pasta and that, but you read the book about pasta because of something else, and that happened because of something else that happened before, and eventually you go back to things that happened before you were born. And if you trace the chain of events back, you'll get back to the beginning of the universe, if the universe had a beginning, or some time before there was any life on Earth. Now, the way that physicists have thought about that is in terms of the idea of determinism. But determinism is the view that if you fix the facts at any point in the past, those facts plus the laws of nature determine everything else in the future, that there's no other way that the future could go once the facts in the past are fixed.
So the question that follows from that, are there... And Janine Ismail makes this argument that, therefore, if you rerun the universe from 14 billion years ago with all of the laws as they are operated for our universe, we'd end up in this conversation we're having now in exactly the same way.
That's right, yeah. So you fix two things. You fix the initial facts, what they call the initial conditions, or how things were at the beginning of time, and the laws of nature. And those two things just determine that we're having this conversation now. But
is it possible that there are things that are not determined by physical laws? Do we have to accept the first principle? You saying no?
I am saying no, but okay. I mean, Tim knows better than me.
What we're saying is there's nothing in the realm of kind of impulse or emotion or the intangible, the ephemeral.
You can argue that that is controlled by physical
laws. Well, is it? Is that right?
Well, that's the consequence of determinism, yeah. If determinism's true and the laws of physics are absolutely general, they apply to absolutely everything in the world, then even though it may look as if the laws of physics have nothing to do with, say, emotion or spontaneity or morality or art or all these other things, as a matter of fact, if determinism is true, there couldn't be any difference in, you know, whether someone judges an act to be wrong, unless there was some difference in the past or difference in the laws of nature.
Well, that's the following point, isn't it? Which, you know, and Janine talks about the clutter murders, which are in Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Because there is if we are a purely deterministic universe, if we accept determinism, punishing someone for a crime makes no logical sense because they could have done nothing other than commit that crime.
But then we can't do anything other than punish them anyway.
Well, that's true. That's true too. But there may be a function in punishment other than which doesn't rely on the criminals being morally responsible. You may think that it's important to keep them away from, you know, doing the crime again, or it's important to keep them away from society. Or what you can't think is that punishing them for the crime requires that they could have done otherwise, because if determinism is true, then they couldn't really have done otherwise.
Now, as you know, Tim, I've defined philosophy on the pages of the TLS of creating a problem that doesn't actually need to matter and then failing to solve it. That is the sort of definition of the great discipline that is philosophy.
Yeah.
Does this pass the common sense test? Because, I mean, are you saying determinism is true, Tim?
Well, I think determinism isn't actually true, because I think that the phenomena of quantum mechanics shows that it isn't true.
I think that's irrelevant
to the question of free will, for the reason that that Janine Trant says in her piece.
Go on, explain that. So, go on. You've just thrown in quantum physics.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Into a morass of difficulty.
No, go for it.
I know. So quantum mechanics says that at the smallest levels of matter, the smallest scale, things like electrons and photons and these fundamental particles, things happen there not as a matter of deterministic law, but only with a certain probability or chance of happening. If quantum mechanics is right, then you could run the universe all over again, and you wouldn't have the same particular history at the level of fundamental particles.
And those fundamental particles could, of course, influence some bigger particles, which is to say, me or you.
Well, they could, but the problem with that is that no one really knows exactly how the fundamental particles relate to the macroscopic world of ordinary objects. That's the problem dramatized by Schrödinger's example of the cat in the box. Schrödinger's cat. I don't know if you know that example, but maybe
we shouldn't go there. Well, no. To find out if the cat's dead or alive, you've got to open the door, and therefore it's both dead and alive before you open the door.
It's something along those lines.
I love saying that to professional philosophers, where I just sort of crash through eons of nuanced thinking with something completely.
Is there another theory as well as quantum mechanics? How about the multiverse theory? Doesn't that also, it puts a bit of a spanner in the works, doesn't it? Because if there is a kind of point at which, you know, the thing is either a wave or a particle, and you're either going to have pasta or rice, one is doing one in one place and another is doing another in the other place. And that, again, that doesn't pass Stig's test of of sounding like common sense, but more and more physicists, I think, or from what I can see, can't refute that because there isn't a good enough argument to refute it. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think multiverse and quantum mechanics are very, very different. Quantum mechanics is one of the best confirmed physical theories ever.
Yes, yeah.
And all sorts of things that we do rely on it, and it's the best theory of matter that there's ever been. The multiverse is pure speculation, and actually the multiverse is a piece of philosophy, really. It doesn't really play any role in it, as I understand it, doesn't really play any role in any real physics. It's kind of cosmological speculation. The idea is that anything that could happen does happen somewhere in another universe. I think it's based on all sorts of dodgy reasoning, but unfortunately, there isn't time to go into that now.
Well, yeah, well, I think we've crashed around all sorts of things rather quickly. So, are you saying though, Tim, that you don't think determinism is true because of quantum mechanics?
Quantum mechanics is irreducibly probabilistic or chancy, then determinism isn't true. But I think that's not relevant to the question of freedom of the will, because I don't think our freedom of the will depends on how things are with absolutely the smallest particles of matter. Freedom of the will is about us and our control over what we do.
But hang on a second, we're also... I'm not sure I buy that, because the argument, which I also don't buy, is that everything that we do is a product of physical things that have happened to us in the past. Not happened to us, happened generally in the past. So if you rerun the universe from before humanity, you still end up with humanity. Why is that not hold true for at the quantum level? Because we're still talking about things that aren't directly connected to us, ultimately leading us to where we are now.
Well, it's not true at the quantum level, just because you run the universe again and an electron has one property in the universe as it actually was, and you run the universe again, and it has another property, and that has no other explanation. It's just a basic probabilistic fact. Now, some people don't accept that, and they say that there must be some further explanation. That's called the hidden variable view, that there must be some further explanation of why the electrons differ in their properties. But my feeling, why I say this has got nothing to do with free will, is that I don't want my free will to depend on how some electron moves in my brain. You know, I want it to depend on me and my own control of my actions.
But do you want it to depend on how some monkey scratched themselves 3 billion years ago? The two are still as unrelated.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But they're not, are they? Because the electron in your brain is your thought process. So that is your free will, not your free will, that is your desires and hopes and beliefs and what you want for tea.
Yeah, some people have a view a bit like that, that they think that genuine free will comes from how particles sort of swerve around in your brain. But again, I think this is pure speculation. So no one knows how the electrons in our brain are related to thought processes. I mean, I think
We're now at the mind-body problem, are we now, Tim? We've hit Schrödinger's cat. We've done quantum. We're now at the mind-body problem, are we?
They're very closely related, mind-body, and the free will problem is in some way more gripping, I think, than the mind-body problem.
Well, I'm not quite sure where you stand on it, Tim. Then, because are you saying that you genuinely do have free will?
Yes.
And therefore, the deterministic, you don't. If you replayed the universe again with the laws of physics remaining constant, you think there's a chance that you would have a different outcome?
Well, I don't know. So I don't have a solution to this.
No one knows!
I think it's a real problem. I think it's a real problem, yeah.
Is it also that you've got free will because of quantum mechanics? So 200 years ago, you might not have thought we had free will because we might have thought that we were living in the clockwork universe and everything was playing out.
Yeah. No, I don't think that. I think quantum mechanics just indicates how things could be otherwise than determinism says. I mean, it shows how determinism could be false. But,
but only at the micro level, not the macro.
Only the micro level, that's right.
And we don't really know, and physicists don't. I mean, one of the great things about learning a little bit about something is to realise how little there is to
other
know in
know.
In some, because it's impossible to say. I mean, I think there's the common sense, the kind of sniff test of all of this, is we like to believe that I could make a decision at any point in the next 20 seconds to just tap the table. And I don't even know when I'm going to do it, because I haven't thought about it, and at some point it's going to happen like that. And to feel that that was somehow set down 14 billion years ago, it just feels improbable, doesn't
it? It's not necessarily that it was, if I understand this right, which I probably don't, and Tim will tell me why, it's not necessarily just that it was set down 14 billion years ago, it's that it's an outcome of the laws of nature. You can't operate outside the laws of physics. You have to operate within the laws of everything as they exist. So there's no superability.
This is absolutely right. So what Stig said is actually a statement of the problem, which is that on the one hand, you can decide to do whatever you like. You can slap your hand on the table whenever you like, exactly when you want. That seems obvious. On the other hand, you can't break the laws of physics. So our actions don't break the laws of physics. If there are laws of physics at all, then they're universal. They apply everywhere. And they control what happens.
And so there's kind of a connection, the sort of Calvinist view of the world, which is that, you know, predestination and double predestination, that God knows. And so you can actually insert God into all of this, can't you? You can say God knows when everything we're going to do, everything that's going to happen, and therefore we can't operate our own free will as moral agents in that sense.
That's right. They're closely related. They're not quite the same thing, because the Calvinists said there's only one possible way the world could be. As the determinist said, things could be other than the way they were if they'd been different at the beginning of time. So if you had a little bit less matter at the beginning of time, then the world would have been different. So the world could have been different. Whereas the Calvinist says the world can only ever be one way. So there's only one possible world for the Calvinist.
Tim, it's an absolute. I do love talking about this sort of stuff. Do you
You
believe in philosophy, really, Stig?
Well, no. I think at one level, I believe in the utter futility of philosophy because we never get anywhere. But I think the journey to getting nowhere is rather a pleasant one.
I agree. apart from the bit about getting nowhere, of course, you get somewhere. It's a journey.
Well, where have we got?
Because you thought about something that you hadn't thought about before.
But that's the journey. My point is,
you are different at the end of the journey than you were at the beginning.
God's sake. That's right.
Yeah, all right.
He's had enough now.
I've had enough of all this. Tim Crane, what a joy speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Stig.
Cheers. Bye bye. The point is, I always find with philosophy, you can bumble along on any of these issues, and then someone says, oh, you know, what is the mind-body problem? And then they don't solve it. So ultimately...
No, but you can't... It's not necessarily about solving. You can set out positions and get somewhere near to the end of it. Or you can have your own position. Tim's got his position.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting because I started reading about this and I thought, oh, I know exactly what I think. And then I thought, no, I've got absolutely no idea.
But maybe you're always going to think that.
Maybe, but maybe... there's all sorts of things going on. There's this idea from this bloke from the determinism thing. I'm going to do a really horrible, awful, bad physics.
Schrodinger's cat thing I just did.
Yeah. It was worse than that. But so in the 19th century, the guy called Laplace, who was one of the guys who sort of thought about determinism, and he had this thing called the demon, the Laplace demon, which you could put at any point in time, either in the past or in the future, and if he knew everything, or she, which you can't, so it's just, you know, it's a thought experiment. If they knew everything, then they could tell you everything that was going on. If they knew all the laws of where everything was, they had all the information available, they could tell you exactly what was going on. But it's only ever theoretical, because that's not ever possible. It's interesting, though, isn't it?
Laplace's demon.
I think so. People can write in and tell me how wrong I am.
Fine. Let's encourage people to do that.
This week in the TLS, we are thinking about the avant-garde. Our cover, if you haven't seen it, is almost entirely blank. Not because we've run out of ideas or had a big weekend, but because we wanted to do something different that we hadn't done before, a break with tradition and perhaps a space where something new can emerge.
It looks lovely, doesn't it?
We think so. I haven't seen it yet. I think it looks splendid.
I hope so, yeah,
You can draw in it whatever you want.
Yeah. It's like we've got the great 18th century man here. It's a bit like Tristram Shandy. Is there a bit in Tristram Shandy, Michael Caine's, where you can draw an image of your ideal mistress?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. To your own liking, I think, is the invitation. Yeah.
Okay, that's enough sexist.
It's not sexist. It's true. It's just, let's just report.
No, that,
I'm just
reporting. Oh, that, yeah. You know.
I wasn't being sexist.
No. Okay. No, all right. Then you're just reporting on it. Can I get through my introduction?
Go on. Yeah.
I was at a space, where something new can emerge.
Exactly.
Is that a good definition of avant-garde? maybe not. But it turns out this is a surprisingly difficult thing to agree on.
Yeah.
So we're looking at the avant-garde this week through art and fiction and poetry, which we will turn to in a bit. But first, Michael Caines, of this parish, has written about a non-traditional approach to writing about books. Dare we call it avant-garde criticism? Maybe we dare. Michael, many thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You've reviewed four books for us. Can you tell us, I'm sorry to do this, but I'm going to just make you do all the work. Can you tell us about the self-imposed rules and restraints of each one?
Are they Olympian rules?
I mean, Michael's going to tell you that, but I'm
nodding.
I think
there's an element of that, yes. Absolutely. I'm going to have a go at describing them and you can tell me whether
fine.
You think
I just mean that we've managed to get Olympian in again, which I think is one of my little mini attempts.
That could be an Olympian rule in itself.
And indeed.
It has to be in the paper,
and so on,
et cetera,
and
et cetera.
So on.
Yeah, these four books definitely have an element of that. The thing they share is they all, I think, the fundamental thing they share is they all blend an element of critical writing with personal writing, with elements of autobiography or something like that. So the first one is called Harvester of Hearts. It's by Rachel Fedder. And the subtitle is Motherhood Under the Sign of Frankenstein. The idea, one of the ideas in it, is that she's writing about feminist responses to Frankenstein and to Mary Shelley's shorter, sort of a novella called Matilda, which was published posthumously. It wasn't published till I think 1959. But if you were going to this book just looking for that information, it'd be quite a frustrating experience, because Fedder was teaching these two works while she was heavily pregnant. She then writes about the experience of, oh gosh, living in 21st century America in the age of Trump. It's under the sign of Frankenstein and in the age of Trump. And she writes in these short paragraphs, sometimes just a couple of lines, sometimes just a line here and there, that dart around between the different strands, all the things she's thinking that turn out to be interconnected. So she writes, of course, about her own life as an academic and as a mother, but also about Mary Shelley's. Mary Shelley had, I think, the only one of her children, I think, to survive her, who was born in the same year that she wrote Frankenstein. So there's definite connections.
Not her hideous progeny.
Not her hideous progeny, yes. Hideous and beautiful progeny. Percy Florence Shelley.
Oh, lovely.
So that's one, and that's got a very distinct style. It's not linear. It's all, I don't want to say fragmentary, because these sections are sort of complete in themselves, but each chapter is a sort of essay that works by these strange little motifs and little sections until you work your way through one particular idea, like erasure or motherhood or something like that. And there's connection, this may be Olympian, who knows. The second book is called The Hundreds, and the clue is in the title. Each section is 100 words or a multiple of 100 words, which could be called cheating.
That sounds
Olympian.
Is that Olympian?
Yeah.
I think that's
got
Olympian feel.
Like
a drabble. A drabble is the name for these things if you're writing a piece of, you know, microfiction or something.
I was about to say something was 100 exercises and something, but it was 99, so I'm not going to say it. Go on.
There's lots of variations on a theme, aren't there? Harry Matthews is an Olympian who wrote a book. Was it 20 lines a day? That's very good. And again, it's just personal, whatever's occurring. It's kind of a notebook, really. This works a bit like that, only it's a collaborative work. It's by Lauren Bernal and Kathleen Stewart. I think one's an English professor, one's a professor of anthropology. And they're looking, I think, at just particular moments, and I think trying to hold back from analysis, you know, bearing down with a big idea in a particular moment, but just capturing these moments and asking questions about how we analyse those things. It's a very interesting work as well, you know, very much like Fedder's, in that its centre isn't one particular work of literature, but lots of particular moments, and it asks questions such as, what influences have you been under? Obviously, she would say, well, I've been working on Frankenstein and Matilda, and by the way, just had a baby. Mm. And they're asking that in lots of various different ways in these 100 word bursts. And so you don't even get really a conventional introduction in an academic conventional way, says, I'm going to do this, and in chapter 5 I do this. And to conclude, you find out about what's going through the mind gradually. It's clearly been a collaborative.
And where do you stand on all this, Michael? Because are you sitting there longing for a monograph?
Has that phrase ever been uttered?
I often think of you sitting and longing for a monograph. I don't know why.
Can you just see
smoking
I'm in the office
pipe,
and I'm looking like I need a monograph. Yeah. Oh God, bring me a monograph, I'm saying.
Because this isn't actually unconnected to our discussion of conspiracy theories. It's the idea of the modern world. Authority is fragmented so much that actually the way to testify to it is not to try and put it together as a coherent whole, but to embrace the fragmentation.
Yeah, I think these books reflect that. You know, there's a kind of conformity, a sort of dull expectation that a book's got to be written a certain way. If it's a critical work, it's got to be written in this particular way. I think that obviously has its place, but these are, I would guess you could call them experiments in doing it differently. The third one is Tunnel Vision by Kevin Breathnach, which has already had a lot of acclaim. It's been out for a couple of months, I think, and it's a series of interconnected essays. It weaves around his own life. There's a lot of sex and drugs and not rock and roll, but modern history and modern art. It's really fantastic and quite sort of sordid. And the last one has got a long title for a short book, On the Literary Means of Representing the Powerful as Powerless, by Stephen Zoltansky. That's a mouthful. But the thing is, his constraint is seems to be time, in that I think his idea is he's going to write the thesis in a day. So although he sets out his plan at the beginning, it's a very short book. You know, you
64 pages.
Yeah, 64 pages. That's as much as apparently you can do in a day's writing about reading. He set a plan at the beginning, and then later on he says, I got really tired.
Couldn't
or he just that. Has to leave a section blank, and just time gets to the evening as I should probably watch a film. So
it's an odd thing to think on the day when you're writing a book, yeah. But anyway.
It's a curious one, that, because you do think as well, I've described it badly, but you might think, well, what connection has that got to the theory he's putting forward, to the, you know, to the his polemical position? And then he ties it together, I think, quite well at the end. He talks about his own sort of, you know, mortality, really, and there's an urgency to the message.
I have a question, Michael, that is this. 20 years ago, anyone writing anything, I'm talking really about all journalism, but also literary criticism, mm-hmm. was pretty much said, don't mention yourself. You should be writing in a sort of the voice of an authoritative third person, sort of almost a ghostly figure that is almost omniscient, and that's what you're writing as. That's the style. And then over the last 20 years, the intrusion of I has happened. And now if you make a pitch to a publisher for a book, you say, I want to write about Shelley, they'll say, do you not mean you want to tread in the footsteps of Shelley and think about how Shelley has influenced you as a person and your love life? And now, is that a bad thing in your book, Michael? Or is it a good thing, or is it to be used with caution?
I don't know if it's good or bad. I think it's one of those things that's a product of our glorious interneted age and all the rest of it. I remember, around that time, 20 years ago, writing my first pieces for the TLS, and an editor said, you know, you can't use I unless you've worked here for 3 years or 2 years or whatever it was. And it was half a joke, it was half serious.
Yeah.
And it's quite, but actually, in a way, it was good discipline just to go, I can describe this book without fatuously or unthinkingly going, I think this, or I did this, or a whole lead paragraph saying, this is what I had for breakfast. Now to the book under review. As a reader, I might not want to know about that stuff. It's got it, but it can work. And I think in these books, it does work pretty well.
See, you know, I think I probably, perhaps more than you, Michael, I'm more sympathetic to the, because I'm quite interested in not quite what people have for breakfast, but the interplay between because to me it seems more honest, because one of the great lies in life is that's really damaging is that everyone else you always imagine is operating in this frictionless void with no issues and nothing interfering with their whatever they're doing. And in fact, everything in terms of how you read a book or how you talk to someone or how you do anything in your life is a product of influences.
Absolutely.
And there's a kind of honesty in testifying to
the laws of nature, I was about to say. The physical laws of nature. Well, seriously, we did free will earlier.
You know, I completely prepared to
we've
accept...
We've done free will.
I completely prepared to confess. I contradict myself. Here I'm saying I think these four books are really interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Great ways
of
reading. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, but they ask exactly those questions. You know, what influences have you been under? What shapes what you write and how you do it.
And that's kind of reader response theory in a way,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's something really just a stylistic thing that I like, the even if it's just a pretense or a piece of ventriloquism, I like the impersonal style for what it can say too.
I think that's it's not that there's no value in that, there's real value in that, because it can be very clear and help you to frame your own thinking. But I think the What I Had for Breakfast school, if you can do both, great, but they're two very different things and they're both quite difficult. And the danger of the What I Had for Breakfast school, I think, is that
name for a school.
It's a very good name for a school. Is that if it's not done well, it just gets a bit boring.
Yeah.
And someone just goes toast.
Oh yeah, it can become just
to do with
it can be just as conventional as the other thing. Well, and I'm thinking, and I find that dull, because we have had decades of it.
Yeah, so, and that's and to broaden this out to avant-garde, it's the same point, isn't it? That really, you know, I once did a review of experimental fiction where I said, the definition of experimental fiction, it's more fun to write than it is to read.
That's your definition.
Yeah, well, I think it often is, because I think there's a certain self-indulgence. And that's what we get to when we talk about avant-garde. You know, we've got, you know, this is a paper full of avant-garde. there's avant-garde art, there's avant-garde poetry, there's avant-garde fiction. When done well, it is making you see something afresh, isn't it? It's taking something and renewing it. When it's done badly, it is a self-indulgent refusal to play by the rules as if you're better than them.
I wonder if those spring from the same thing as well. On my way down here, I was just wondering whether avant-garde is really the ultimate misnomer. It comes from a political context in the 1820s, from utopian socialism, apparently. So the idea is artists would be in the vanguard for society, not for art. Now, that comes much later. I mean, you can talk about all these things together. It's obviously a very woolly term. It can stretch and go in different ways. It covers lots of different movements. But I wonder whether it's wrong when it comes to just thinking about art or literature or music or whatever, in that it's actually maybe a stopping and saying, hang on, what we have at the moment doesn't work. We've got to start something again. You could talk about Courbet as being, you know, and realist art in the mid 19th century as being a reaction to art as it was, and saying this doesn't work. How about this? Yeah. You take the rough with the smooth. You need that experiment to renew art, make something interesting out of it again. So actually, it's not the vanguard; it's the rear guard, and they're picking things up as they go along. Yeah. And well, hang on, that didn't work.
And also, I think there's an argument that you kind of refresh the gene pool a bit. Yeah, so although, yeah, as an individual, I might not want to read a vast novel that's only one paragraph. Mm-hmm. Or I might get to parts of Ulysses where I struggle. Mm-hmm. But is the gene pool of the medium refreshed by this type of stuff happening? There's a benefit that goes on past it, isn't it? Because you're shaking things up.
Yeah, there's an argument that there's a kind of, you know, capitalist or a bourgeois, whatever you call it, an appetite for novelty. So these things come along, as you say, some don't take, and they're still weird to us now, and grappling to understand them. They'll never take. A few specialists and kind of literary virtue signalers will go, oh, I like that, I'm good, look, check me out. But other things will take, and they're easier to deal with.
And it's always good to have someone jumping in with new ideas, I think, isn't it? How is that not a good thing?
Well, there is an argument, and it's been put in the TLS a couple of times, that really just any significant art, anything worth its salt, does chance its arm and does do something new. So that's one massive big problem for describing avant-garde. It's partly a social construct, let's say, to do with movements and so on.
I tell you what, I feel we've tackled some three large topics, but they're too large in the sense of they're impossible to do in 15 minutes.
Let's do a podcast of 3.5 hours.
Avant-garde. Does that sound avant-garde or just
Let's
more
do
fun to write?
Let's do a perfectly silent podcast of 3.5 hours. More, no, our producer's shaking his head. Yeah. Let's not do
more
that.
More fun to do than to listen to, I think, would be the definition of that. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to the Dr. Michael Caines, Jill Lepore and Tim Crane. Do get yourself a copy of the TLS this week. The cover is an interesting experiment in avant-garde minimalism. Or subscribe so you never miss an issue. Next week, we have a history special full of good stuff. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.